you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be a variety of security news and updates. Some of these are just things you should be aware of, and other things that are directly actionable by you. So I'm going to actually get some little tips for some browser updates here for you. All right, so let's get started. First, let's talk about an interesting Trojan that is seemingly pervasive right now in the Android world. Now, for those of you that have Android devices where you are avoiding installing apps from, you're avoiding installing apps from kind of unconfirmed, unauthorized sources, then you've got quite a lot of protections already in place by just not installing apps from weird places. Now, that isn't always going to be possible. In some cases, there are apps that are completely legitimate, especially security apps, that are not installable through the Google Play Store. So not only are they not installable through there, but their updates are also not installable through there. So it's important for you to know the difference between, you know, updates that are legitimately not coming through the Google Play Store, you know, versus other things. Now, what this problem comes from is people love to play with a whole lot of different apps. And so it seems that when they get one of these Trojan-infected apps on their mobile device, what this app will do is attempt to hack the wireless router that the device is connected to. So if at that point in time the device is only connected to a cellular data connection, well then that's obviously going to be unsuccessful. If it is on a wireless network, then this Trojan-infected app attempts to hack the wireless router that it's connected to. And this can be possible not only through brute force attempts, but also through a mechanism where the default password exists on that wireless router. And the interesting piece of the theme song here with this is, for years now, we've been talking about how if you do use a consumer-grade wireless router, you need to change the default password. Now, these consumer-grade wireless routers are, you know, by and large, they're not security appliances. So they are vulnerable to brute force password hacking attempts. So first off, on these wireless routers, these consumer-grade wireless routers, you can't even change the standard built-in admin account. So it's just admin. You can't change the name of it. So that's one thing. Well, at least you have the opportunity to change the password, so you need to. And if not, then what happens is, well, the neighbors could end up changing the contents of your wireless router, which I've actually seen that happen locally. But also Trojans like this can get in there and then change settings. Now, the very horrible part of changing settings is it changes the DNS, the primary and secondary DNS, that is handed out to the connected devices, and it changes those DNS servers to be malicious servers owned and operated by the bad guys. Now, where this really becomes a big problem for you is that this is literally called DNS hijacking. Now, if this mobile device that was hacked, maybe it was your friend or one of your children's friends, this is, of course, one of the big things that I think most people are not aware of is they allow the children's friends to get on their wireless network at the house. And you have no idea what sort of malicious garbage is running around on these mobile devices where, you know, kids are just, they really just do not have a sense for security most of the time. And they just click on stuff and go, oh, that's got to be interesting. Let's try this game and let's try that and let's try these other things. They're very much so interested in what's trending and what's happening, and they want to be included in the supposedly cool stuff that's being tweeted about, etc. So they really don't think about, oh, well, my phone could be hacked. Sorry, let's say that these people end up getting on your network and you've left the default password there or their mobile devices on your network long enough to the point where this malware is able to brute force attack the password on your wireless router, then those DNS settings are changed. Now, those DNS settings are permanently changed until you realize it. So those DNS settings could be permanently changed and you might not know for, you know, 6-9 months till whenever. I mean, you might not know for a long time. And so you go about your business doing your online banking and your email and your shopping and all these normal things you do with your computer. And in the meantime, all of your traffic is getting routed through these malicious DNS servers that are going to redirect you to other fake sites and other malicious sites that are going to steal your banking credentials or steal your credit card or your personally identifiable information or your passwords. DNS hijacking is a catastrophically scary, scary stuff. So in order for you to mitigate this threat, you can do many things. Number one, change the default password on the wireless router. Number two, use a good network design, which is a network design that does not allow guests to connect to your secure network. So we're talking about a strategy that has a guest network and then more of a trusted network. But even beyond that, then now use a long, secure 16 or more character password for the wireless router that is made up of complex characters, uppercase, lowercase, special characters, and numbers. And the best of all is don't use a consumer wireless router. Get a perimeter security appliance that is business class and use that. And then in that way, you're pretty much guaranteed to not be able to ever be vulnerable to a DNS hijacking attack. Okay, so if you want to know more about that, I'm posting a link to that. Now, the next thing that you should know about is if you use Firefox, a researcher has found that Firefox has a setting that saves your browser session every 15 seconds. Now, this researcher had a very legitimate concern over that. He inquired about, well, what does this do to your hard drive activity rate? So he actually did a lot of forensic analysis on this and found that the default setting of saving your browser session configuration every 15 seconds created a ton of hard drive traffic. And this can lead to fragmentation on the computer, which hampers performance. And it can also lead to premature wear and tear on the hard drive of the computer. So certainly if the browser is actually closed, well, then it's not doing this. But a lot of people just leave their browser windows open all the time instead of closing them. So he did some testing and found that you can quite easily alter the browser session store interval. Now, I've tested this setting for several weeks now, and I think that it's a very good setting, and I highly recommend everybody uses it. I am going to post some instructions for you to be able to implement that on your own, so check out the accompanying article here with this podcast. And for organizations that use Firefox in an organizational sense, then the challenge becomes, and I do think that Firefox is quite important of a browser to have. You can't, it can be very difficult for an organization to go through life without multiple browsers that they're supporting, Firefox being one of them, because there's a lot of entities that have standardized on a particular browser that they are developing their website for. And, they will say things like, well, if you're going to do business with us and you're going to interact with our website, then you need to be using this type of, you need to be using this particular browser because that's the only one that we actually test with. And so if you call them and say, well, I've got a problem with your website, and you're not using the latest and greatest version of the browser that they officially support for their website, then they're just going to tell you to, you know, go download that browser and install it. So state of Wisconsin is one of those. And there's other states that are like this. So if you're an organization that does business with the state of Wisconsin for, oh, maybe, you know, sales tax or business tax or withholding tax or payroll tax or, you know, any number of those sorts of things that you have to pay to the state of Wisconsin, you're probably going to need Firefox as a browser because that is the only browser that state of Wisconsin officially supports. And I don't blame them whatsoever. I mean, I actually fully support that sort of strategy because as a cost savings measure, an organization like that cannot make a statement that says we're going to support every browser under the sun and put development effort into that, because the more browsers that you are officially supporting and testing changes with, that's more expense and more development cost. And, you know, so actually I fully support state of Wisconsin in doing that. But so we need to be aware of the fact that we live in a multiple browser world. I mean, at any one point in time, virtually everybody that I know that's in business is finding that they have to run with 2 to 3 browsers, if not 4. And it really comes down to the fact that there is no one browser out there that will work with all websites all the time. It just doesn't happen. We no longer live in that world. And we used to have this kind of ideology that was, well, use the most secure browser. Well, the fact remains is that the most secure browser is not necessarily the browser that that website is going to work with at that time. So the approach has really dramatically had to change. And that approach is, well, you need to secure all of your browsers. And the challenge there is that the way that you secure each one of the browsers is can be a different approach. So for example, with Google Chrome as a browser, one of the things you can do to dramatically improve the security of that browser is to install ScriptSafe. You can also install AdBlock Plus. AdBlock Plus is available for Firefox as well. So there are a lot of these free plugins that are quite good and quite secure that can really dramatically improve the security of the browser. In fact, it was about 6 months ago that I worked with a gentleman down in Florida who had found that his machine, his computer, was pretty effectively hacked, and it had a browser injection attack that was active on it. And the only reason that he found out about it is because I had suggested that he install ScriptSafe in order to do some isolation testing to find out where perhaps this hack that had happened to him had come from. And because all of his credentials had been stolen, he eventually found he had a keystroke logger on his computer. And it came through, it was pretty obvious how he got it, because he wasn't using a perimeter security appliance and he didn't have any security software on his computer and he was browsing the internet as an admin account. So, I mean, in that rate, it's inevitable. You could probably go a day like that and end up getting hacked because the risk profile of that approach is so ginormous. Okay, so unfortunately, I did quite a lot of research into this. There does not seem to be a consistent, easy to deploy, group policy based or script based approach to deploying this Firefox browser customization for your entire organization. So this is going to be something where if you really want to take advantage of this tweak, then it has to be done as a user education standpoint and a request that people modify the browser settings on their own. And they do have the permissions to do that because this is a profile-based setting. Okay, let's on the next topic is really a fascinating article where Google is actively being sued right now by at least one employee for illegally muzzling workers. And this is not really surprising to me from the perspective that many, many, many years ago, Google violated one of its core tenets it had an ethical philosophy when Google as a company was first put together by the founders, and one of their philosophies was don't be evil. Well, that philosophy was effectively removed probably about 10 years ago, and they have progressively been doing things that a lot of people would characterize as evil. One of them, for example, is they bought General Dynamics, and they're literally engaged in the production of warfare robots at this point. So, you know, a lot of people would think about that as being, yeah, evil. So, however, from an employee perspective, you know, you look at Google as supposed to be a company that is advocating for transparency and openness and free market, and they're supposed to not be engaging in filtering search results, but providing you unbiased, unfiltered search results. Yet, probably not a month goes by that we're not hearing about proven circumstances where Google has intentionally manipulated search results in order to hide search results that they did not like in their political ideology. So the company's become very politicized. Well, this latest piece of news about Google being sued by one of their employees is really shocking because it adds to this story of Google and how it's transformed as a culture, at least from an executive management policy standpoint over the years. And this latest one are these allegations, and there's quite a lot of astonishing level of proof that's being offered in this lawsuit, that literally it's a fireable offense at Google to whistleblow or to disclose salaries, work skills, or experience to future employers. Now, that's pretty shocking because, you know, if an employee has left Google or they're looking to get a job at another employer, this is their own information about what salary did they make while they were employed there and what were their work skills and experience while they were there. But yet, according to Google's own policies, it is a fireable offense to whistleblow or to disclose salaries, work skills, experience, or future employers. Now, there's a lot more interesting tidbits in this article. I do highly recommend that you go to the website for this podcast and pull the link for that article if you're interested. It really goes into a tremendous amount of detail about that, but it concerns me because it just is the latest piece of information that we have about Google where they are really on a very dangerous path to totalitarianism, if that is what they're going to do to their employees, because that's really flat out illegal. So the next interesting news tidbit is about Uber. Uber, the private taxi ride company, and they have been exposed as tracking your every move as part of what they call improved customer satisfaction with regards to connecting drivers and riders. And the way that their app works is it definitely takes your location information all the time, and any time that the app is actually open, it will grab your location information and it transmits it to Uber. Now, their standpoint is they say, well, we're collecting this information so that we can charge you accurately for the trip cost, but they are also saying, well, by us tracking your location information, this ensures that the drivers are able to locate you effectively. And that's, you know, they can make some legitimate arguments there, and if you choose to utilize Uber's services, then I can see where you've consented to that. But the part where the consent stops is where Uber has publicly stated that their software continues to track your very, very specific location information for 5 minutes after your ride has finished, and even if the app is closed. So imagine you've taken a ride on Uber, you end up at a drop-off point, and technically all that they needed was the drop-off point in order to calculate the cost for your ride. They don't need to know where you physically walked after the ride was completed. Unfortunately, they are collecting that very specific data on you for 5 minutes time period after the ride has completed. And they admit to the fact that they're doing this. And where it gets really intense is now New York City is saying that they want that data as well on top of the data of what was your ride. Now, the whole reason that the what was your ride data is being shared with New York City is because New York City has labor laws for taxi drivers that say we need to have accurate records for payroll, wages, etc. for taxi drivers. And of course, that's a whole nother topic as to why they want to collect that data. Nonetheless, they feel they have a legitimate right to that. But because Uber is now collecting this this 5 minutes after the ride has ended data, New York City is saying they want access to that as well. And so this is a fine example of how terms and conditions can change after you consent to being a recipient of a particular service. The terms and conditions can change. You know, how well does that company tell you about the terms and conditions changes? And we have to be very careful about what data is even being collected on people, because if it's being collected at all, then it can be disclosed. And it can be disclosed legally or illegally. And even if it's disclosed legally, is your perception of that disclosure something that is appropriate or not? Or does it seem like totalitarianism, like a page out of Orwell's 1984? Because I'm pretty certain that that sort of data could be utilized dramatically to create a profile of an individual that isn't just a matter of, oh, they were dropped off at the corner of this intersection. It's, no, they were dropped off at the corner of this intersection, and then they proceeded three buildings down on the block and went into the mental health care facility. So that's the kind of data that can be utilized in an inappropriate way to then destroy people's lives. So we as citizens should be very concerned that this data is being collected at all, because of course if it's being collected, the government is going to want it. And in the majority of the cases, whenever the government collects data, it ends up getting disclosed to, oh, you know, the Chinese hackers, such as the OPM breach, you know, or it's just used to target people. And this is nothing new. You know, we have the days of J. Edgar Hoover, we have the days of Nixon, we have the days of many other administrations that have literally used personally identifiable information and profiling of individuals to harm them and persecute them. So we should be aware of these things. There was another very interesting article lately that was talking about how Yahoo said that they've just realized that, well, really the breach that they had was really 1 billion user accounts. And in reading about this, I found something that I didn't know, which was rather interesting, is that Yahoo is actually one of the largest utilized email services internationally. It's really interesting because in the United States, that's not the case. On the other hand, though, if you go international and you look at what is the predominant email service being used internationally, it actually ends up being Yahoo. And so that turns Yahoo into a very significant treasure trove target, not only for governments, but also for the bad guys. And so at this point, I'm of the opinion that if you are running a corporate network or your organization's network, you really should just block Yahoo. Just block it straight out. And here's why. Because number one, Yahoo is willingly spying on every single account holder on behalf of the U.S. government. Then they can't protect basic information from being breached, such as usernames and passwords. They didn't even know they had been breached for quite a while. And then when they did know it, then they didn't publicly declare it. So there's a lot of foot dragging with regards to security concerns. And then let's roll back the clock to 2014, where Yahoo advertisements were actually hosting malicious Java code and were used to hack about 300,000 computers per hour in Europe. So, you know, if you just want to stop a gigantic breach vector from being a, you know, an attack surface against your organization, then just block Yahoo. All right, just block it outright. All right, so let's, the next topic here is the 6-second credit card hack via distributed guessing. This was absolutely a fascinating tactic, and it's something that we all should be aware of because we think about how actually reasonably secure credit cards actually end up being. And there really are a lot of security protections around credit cards. And unless you're doing things really silly, the probability of having your credit card number breached is not that high. Well, so now what's been happening, though, is portions of credit card numbers, like the credit card number itself, might be getting breached. However, the data that's corresponding to it, such as the expiry date or the current 3-digit CVV, can be harder to get a hold of. And the interesting piece here is that there's a lot of old databases of credit card transactions that are out there that have actually been breached. And so the bad guys know what your name and credit card number is. But probably the credit card company, when your old card expired, they didn't change your number. They just simply changed the expiry date and the 3-digit CVV code. And what these hackers are now doing is they're doing distributed guessing attacks. So they use large-scale website processing, e-commerce processing, to do this distributed guessing attack to literally take only about 6 seconds to complete a successful distributed guessing attack on your credit card details. And that really condensed time frame bypasses Visa's, you know, protection measures in place that says that they're effectively going to lock out your account if there's a too many successive number of times of bad guesses for that information within a time period. So condensing all those attacks into that 6-second time period means that the distributed merchant processing system literally cannot converge the bad attempt data in that time period. And as a result, the bad guys figure out what the real card details are, and then they're able to utilize that to go and engage in tons more credit card fraud as a result. I thought that was just really fascinating. There's really nothing that we as consumers can do about that, but it just really brings to light some of the challenges that these companies that, you know, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover have to deal with in terms of the creativity of what these hackers are up to. And I'm just going to finish the show with a very, very, very brief story about how proper network design has been proven time and time and time again to literally prevent massive problems on networks. A company I've been working with literally had a brute force attack against their domain controller stopped in its tracks simply because of proper network design and utilizing a perimeter security appliance as the core router. So if you're not using that strategy, I highly encourage you to give some more thought to that, because it is a proven strategy for protecting.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is